Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Warrior, How to Support Those Who Protect Us, by Shauna Springer, Ph.D. Narrated by Shauna Springer, Ph.D. I dedicate this book to Lieutenant Colonel Brett A. Hart, call sign Stork, a good Marine who is irreplaceable to the many Marines he supported and those in his home front tribe who deeply love him.
Forward. Narrated by Major Scott A. Husing, United States Marine Corps, retired. I opened my eyes. I knew I wasn't dead. Not yet, anyway. The world came into view. For a second, I thought the enemy had stopped firing at us. They hadn't. We were all deaf from the RPG blast. It had detonated 2 feet from my face. My left arm was burning. I looked down and saw what was left of it. It was blown off about mid-forearm, and I could see my jagged, splintered bones jutting out from a bloody, scorched, flayed-open stump. I knew I had lost my left hand. My right hand was killing me. I raised it up in front of my face to get a good look at it. It was blown off at the base of my hand. There were a few uneven bone fragments sticking out where my palm used to be. It looked as if some of the skin that used to be my hand was dangling, shredded to pieces, like someone removed all the bone and flesh from inside. It hung like an empty glove that had gone a few rounds with a garbage disposal. I thought, fuck, both of them? I wasn't done assessing the situation, though. I looked down and saw that my left leg was blown wide open, my femur split in half, like a jagged, splintered water hose. It pumped out huge amounts of blood with every heartbeat. Imagine a coffee cup full of blood, hot blood. Now imagine that every time your heart beats, you toss about that much blood out of your cup and down your thigh. The coffee cup would fill up again in between heartbeats. I knew I only had so many cups of coffee left in me. My leg had almost been blown in half. I took one look at the gleaming white bones sticking out of a sea of red, and I knew I was dead if I didn't stop that bleeding. How was I going to get a tourniquet on my leg and both arms when I didn't have hands? The fight wasn't over yet. I knew I needed to use my head. Trauma sucks, even for combat veterans. I don't think anyone would disagree. I do, however, think combat veterans have a unique resiliency and fortitude to deal with trauma. Somewhere along the line, I feel America's perspective changed toward combat wounded veterans and the trauma we experienced. Where once we were venerated, now we are often pitied. I speak from personal experience. I was no stranger to war on the day that I lost my arms and nearly bled to death in Fallujah, Iraq. I was injured during my second deployment to Iraq, having taken part in the invasion in 2003 prior to that. There wasn't much I hadn't seen or experienced by then. I remember waking up in the intensive care unit, ICU, at the National Naval Medical Center, NNMC, Bethesda, Maryland Hospital. I think the ICU staff thought I had sustained a serious head trauma because of my attitude. I was happy, too happy. It didn't make sense to them, and I don't blame them for being confused. Hell, I used to tell my teammates that if I ever lost an arm or a leg, they should go ahead and put me out of my misery. From the outside looking in, I should have been devastated. Both my hands were blown off completely. My left leg was wrapped in plastic. The tissue of my thigh and shin shredded to oblivion, skin grafts were in the near future for me. No less than 6 suction tubes connected me to the wall. I could see my injuries, and I could remember every bit of the sights, sounds, and pain associated with taking a direct hit with an RPG. What a horrible thing for anyone to have to go through, right? Yes, perhaps, if you allow yourself that perspective. But that's not my perspective. And perspective is the hallmark of resilience. The first time I met Doc Springer face to face was in Chicago. I was there to undergo a medical procedure called stellate ganglion block, a promising new treatment for symptoms of trauma. It had been 14 years since I was wounded. 14 years that weren't easy. Recently, I decided to man up and be the warrior I know I am. To me, this meant I had to work on my mental fitness with as much, if not more, effort than I had put into my physical fitness or any other discipline. I am fortunate that in my journey towards improving my mindset and emotional well-being, a brother I served with introduced me to Doc Springer. I had seen firsthand how our approach had helped out my fellow combat veterans so much. That was enough for me to personally vet her, as we veterans like to do. Before I was wheeled back to the procedure room, I had a conversation with Doc Springer, who was bedside before, during, and after the procedure, providing overwatch like she does. As I progressed through the procedure, we spoke about personal concerns of mine and of trauma. I explained to Doc Springer that what I struggled with daily was not the loss of my hands or the disability it implied. She nodded with a look of recognition and said to me, "I bet a lot of people assume that your biggest trauma, the one that has been the most challenging, is the loss of your arms. But I can see that's not the case for you. You've adapted and overcome in that area the way Marines do. Your trauma is not what most people assume. And this is the truth that many people, even people with advanced clinical training, cannot see. What I struggled with was the trauma I had experienced throughout my entire life, not just my combat experience, least of all my combat wounds. By the time I got injured in Iraq, my trauma was already in place. And any trauma I sustained on the day I got hit by the RPG was far overshadowed by the pride I felt." As I explained to Doc Springer, in becoming a recon Marine, I felt like I had accomplished my greatest goal. I was part of an elite team of warriors. On that day in Iraq, despite life-threatening injuries, I acquitted myself honorably on the battlefield. I lost my hands as a true warrior. For myself, and for so many other veterans, the term hero makes us feel awkward. What feels more awkward, though, is to hear that term bookended in a conversation by pity. Doc Springer doesn't emit pity because she understands the warrior spirit at an instinctive level. She has a no-nonsense approach to treating or preventing PTS. She communicates that we are strong enough to overcome the challenges before us, and that we can do this by using skills we possess already, whether we realize it or not. This is a book about the challenges we face, but make no mistake about Doc Springer's approach. She doesn't see us as broken. She calls to our strength, and she walks with us in a way that translates like this: "I see the challenges before you, and I can help you get clear on them as well. Now get up and fight." Sergeant Eddie Wright, USMC, retired. Bravo Company, 2nd Platoon, 1st Reconnaissance Battalion. Operation Iraqi Freedom 1 and 2.
Preface. Every year we donate hundreds of millions of dollars to causes that support service members, veterans, and first responders. We allow our military service members to board airplanes before we do. We honor them at ball games. We have an insatiable appetite for movies like American Sniper, books written by Navy SEALs, and warrior stories on television, like Jack Ryan, The Unit, and SEAL Team. The preview for the remake of Top Gun instantly went viral. All of this suggests that we're interested in the experiences of our nation's warriors, and we care about the well-being of those who risk it all to protect us. And yet, despite all the thanking veterans for their service, today's veterans tell me that they feel no better understood by society than our Vietnam veterans did. They tell me that they often feel invisible, like ghosts trying to navigate through a culture that has values that are completely different than their values. Many people in society, including a fairly large number of therapists, seem to think that veterans come back traumatized by what they see and do in combat. Through public and private funding, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars to develop effective treatments for post-traumatic stress and to diagnose and better understand TBI. We are told that these are the invisible wounds of war. We have trained up thousands of clinicians across the VA to deliver empirically supported treatments for the trauma of being exposed to war. And yet the idea that veterans die by suicide because they deploy to war zones is a misconception. A 2015 study of nearly 4 million U.S. service members and veterans found that deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan is not associated with an increased risk of suicide. There are some injuries that are even more invisible, more insidious, and more lethal than the invisible wounds of war that we have focused so much time and money to address. For many of my patients, the hidden pain they carried came from other sources. For instance, 5 very common sources were childhood traumas, moral injuries, past experiences of social rejection upon entering treatment settings, feelings of alienation from their closest family members and civilians in general, and the helpless rage and overwhelming grief of losing fellow veterans to combat, training accidents, and suicide. How can warriors be heroes and broken at the same time? My recent book, Beyond the Military, Leader's Handbook for Warrior Reintegration, was written to shift the paradigm of transition. Instead of seeing veterans as broken and needing help to go from a sitting position to a standing position, Beyond the Military provides a roadmap to help warriors fulfill their full potential in life after military service. Our nation's warriors have an abundance of grit, but they're not superhuman. They're humans, just like us, with a clarity of purpose and bonds of love and trust that allow them to accomplish superhuman feats. This is a book about the challenges faced by some of our strongest and bravest citizens. It is necessary to focus targeted attention on these challenges if we're to better understand them. But as Sergeant Eddie Wright expressed in the foreword, this is not a book that perpetuates the myth that warriors are broken. Armed with the right insights, warriors can and will heal and go on to become stronger than they've ever been. Traumas don't just break us down. They are defining moments that can show us how strong we really are. They are moments that help us see our deeper purpose and the values that guide a meaningful life. And strength takes on different forms in different contexts. In battle, it might mean suppressing our natural human emotions in the heat of a firefight to stay laser-focused on our objective. In mental warfare, it might mean taking the harder path, acknowledging our struggles with those we trust, and drawing from the strength of our tribe to overcome these struggles. Who is a healer, really? A doctor with many years of formal education and training may or may not be a healer. In some cases, the way a doctor practices is the reason why a veteran drops out of treatment, never to return. But a doc, someone who builds a kind of deep trust veterans had in the service with their medics, that person is a healer. A wife or a parent who recognizes and helps carry the grief of their military loved one, these are healers. A husband who listens with love and empathy to his warrior wife, he becomes essential in bringing her all the way home. Fellow students in classrooms who respectfully integrate veterans into their college communities, they become healers. Even actors who turn down roles that perpetuate one-dimensional myths of veterans as either heroes or broken gear, who instead pursue roles that portray veterans as multifaceted human beings, like all of us, they become healers. What is a healer? It is all of us, or none of us, depending on what we understand and how this moves us to act in support of those who protect us. The surprise gift. We can learn much about our own condition by understanding those who protect us, their struggles, their triumphs, their bonds with each other. In the vein of Sebastian Junger's tribe, there are indescribably beautiful aspects to the connection that military brothers and sisters share. Like Junger's tribe, warrior is a true crossover, knitting together the worlds of the warrior and those they protect in thought-provoking ways. Additionally, rather than applying solely to those who serve in the military and those who care for them, warrior seeks to develop psychological insight and meaningful personal growth for a broad readership through close observation of how hidden pain, courage, and love show up in the stories of some of the bravest men and women in our society. Warrior gives thoughtful consideration to subjects that have not been well explored as yet. For example, moral injury. How to approach conversations about firearm safety. The links between shame, grief, and suicidal ideation. The ways that current suicide approaches may be failing us. The trust gap between warriors and civilian treatment providers. And the bond between veterans and their trusted healers. The subjects in this book are not only undeveloped as yet, but they are also critical and very timely. Finally, a unique feature of the book is that insights are paired with exercises and questions for further reflection. Writing this book has been a labor of love. I have walked on sacred ground with many of our nation's service members, veterans, and first responders. As we have walked together, I have learned a great deal from them. They have taught me about different kinds of courage and the bonds of love with a power greater than despair. I hope that what I've written here helps us to better support those who risk it all to protect us and to better support each other as well. Introduction. The story goes that a boy of Sparta stole a fox and concealed it under his cloak. As he was sitting in the classroom, surrounded by other students and instructors, the fox began to eat his midsection. The boy sat without moving, in plain view of lots of people, while the fox continued to hollow out his stomach, until finally, without a cry of pain, he suddenly dropped dead. The legend of the boy of Sparta has been used to illustrate the value the Spartan culture placed on Stoicism. In other words, suffering in silence. I think the legend of the boy of Sparta is actually about shame. In fact, in Gates of Fire, a depiction of the Spartans and the epic battle of Thermopylae, author Stephen Pressfield artfully alludes to the proverbial fox when speaking of the secret shame of the warrior. The knowledge within his own heart that he could have done better, done more, done it more swiftly, or with less self-preserving hesitation. This censure gnawed unspoken and unrelieved at the men's guts. Hidden pain is like a fox in our gut. It can silently, steadily hollow us out over time. Suffering in silence can be dangerous, even lethal in some cases. Guilt, shame, and private burdens of grief may become deadly enemies for some of the strongest, bravest people in our society, our combat warfighters. However, let me be very clear. Although the insights shared in this book come from my frontline work with hundreds of veterans, these are not veterans' issues. These are human issues. The way we handle our hidden pain as individuals and as a society will determine our growth and renewal or our collective decay. By examining the greatest vulnerabilities of our strongest and bravest citizens, we can gain new insight into things that many of us thought we understood. For example, trust, stigma, firearms, the imploding mind, and connection. As well as offering us a window into how our bravest citizens may struggle, our warfighters have much to teach us about true courage and the bonds of love that keep us in the fight. The chapters to follow focus on themes of hidden pain, courage, and love, viewed through the lens of my work with veterans, with many areas of wide-ranging application to help all of us deepen our relationships and live better lives. Each chapter traces a stream of observations from my work with veterans into an array of insights about the human condition. Chapters 1 through 4 draw back the curtain on the scene of where veterans receive their care, showing us how a cultural and trust gap between veterans and many of their healers that hope to support them becomes a barrier to care. Chapter 1 examines the cultural divide between frontline emotional responders to veterans and first responders, those who work in mental health clinics. We explore the importance of developing trust if we are ever to see the hidden pain of those we serve. We also reflect on how the very things that we often use to establish trust can actually work against building trust with those we are trying to reach. Chapter 2 takes a fresh look at stigma to help us see why some people who are new to care are actively looking for a good reason to never return. We explore what it takes to overcome stigma and how progressing in treatment calls for a new definition of strength. Chapter 3 examines the myths we create and the stories we tell that are shaming to groups of people. We examine how this shame plays out, even in the spaces that are set up to be the safest and most supportive healing environments we have to offer. Chapter 4 explores how physical objects and tools can become extensions of our identity. As in the case of firearms, for many of our combat warfighters and first responders. We examine why conversations about firearm safety are so challenging and why they may lead those we serve to drop out of care entirely. We also explore several ways to change the conversation so that we can better align ourselves with those we're serving. Chapters 5 and 6 examine the hidden pain that is often more invisible than the invisible wounds of war: moral injury, guilt, shame, and grief. Chapter 5 illustrates how guilt and shame can become lethal. We explore the story of suicide and how shame may be the critical, overlooked link in the explanatory model for many who die by suicide, both veterans and civilians alike. Chapter 6 focuses on how the bonds of love we share can be both life-threatening and life-renewing. We explore human connection in the context of grief and loss, and we reflect on how we can carry love forward to create a meaningful life. Chapter 7 explores a different type of courage than the courage required to meet a flesh-and-blood enemy in the combat zone. We examine the kind of courage that allows us to be vulnerable with those we love and trust. We also reflect on how the ability to extend one's tribe beyond just one group of individuals is critical for our long-term health and happiness. Chapter 8 takes a fresh look at conflict in our closest relationships. We explore the value of conflict and develop key insights for learning how to have a good fight. Chapters 9 and 10 provide a fresh perspective that will help us get traction in a different kind of war, the one that can happen in our minds. Chapter 9 suggests that our current suicide prevention strategies have not been based on the right questions or the best possible approach. We observe that there is a power greater than despair, and we take a close look at what keeps us in the fight during our times of greatest struggle. Finally, in Chapter 10, I argue that without a clear understanding of the challenge at hand, we cannot build a good strategy for action. I provide a tactical analysis of how despair comes over us and what we can do to overcome this despair. Chapter 10 also contains specific examples of innovative suicide prevention approaches that have come from many years of frontline work with those who have found hope within the deepest valleys of their lives. 1. A little secret about secrets. About 10 years ago, I accepted a job at the Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, hoping to make a difference in the lives of our nation's veterans. Taking a job at the VA was my way of serving our country. I wanted to deploy the training I had received over many years in graduate school to benefit my veteran patients. I was idealistic and brimming with optimism. On my first day at the VA, my new supervisor handed me a list of approximately 100 names and said, "These vets have been waiting for you to start for the past several months. Call all of them, find out what they need, and get them scheduled if they want to come in. Fair warning, a good number of them are mad about how long it took us to get you hired and onboarded in place of the last psychologist, who was very well liked by his patients." I hadn't even met my patients, and I was already in the hole. Most of the people I called were gracious, but as I had been warned, some of them were very angry. On hearing my voice, one patient said, "So, you're the new hire. What are you, like 25 years old? Why do they keep hiring people who can't relate to veterans, who have no military or life experience?" I flushed hot with shame, stung by the intensity of his criticism. On some level, I knew this wasn't about me. But on another level, he had a point. Who was I to presume that I could understand the experiences of combat warfighters when I had spent the better part of the last decade in graduate school? This is the thought that shamed me, that I had nothing of value to offer to those I wanted to support. Based on these initial outreach calls to my new patients, it became obvious to me that there was a deep cultural gap and a trust gap that would need to be overcome if I were to be useful in my new role. At the time, it was hard to come into such a hostile environment in the first weeks of my new job. In retrospect, though, it was a gift and an opportunity for growth in disguise, as many growth opportunities are. The initial anger I felt from some of my patients, which I knew on some level was not personal, nonetheless compelled me to take a hard look at how to build trust with all of them. I decided to approach my time at the VA like an enlistment. I would serve 4 years and then decide whether or not to re-enlist for another 4 years. I spent the next 8 years, to the day, examining any barriers to trust that I could control. I thought about who my patients perceived me to be as a relatively young, blonde, civilian female in the early part of my career. I considered the way I decorated my office space, even the way I dressed. Most important, I realized that in replacing the provider they had trusted, I was the FNG, the effing new guy, from where my patients sat. They had attached to him and had trusted him with their private pain. In replacing him, I had to overcome both a deficit of trust and the residual effects of an unexpectedly severed attachment with their previous doc. Trust outranks rank. Many of this initial group of patients were Vietnam veterans, and so for many of them, there was a further, deeper dimension to the initial gap in trust between us. Understanding leadership structures in the military is the key for gaining insight. For those who are unfamiliar with military culture, there are often two parallel lines of leadership in military rank structures. Some leaders are non-commissioned officers, NCOs, who rise from within, gaining credibility from their boots-on-the-ground experience. Others gain rank by attending colleges or military institutions and enter leadership roles as commissioned officers. Many of those who were drafted into the Vietnam War or who enlisted grew to distrust commissioned officers tasked with leading units and developing combat strategies. During the Vietnam War, it was not uncommon for an officer with no prior combat zone experience to be appointed to a leadership position that would outrank someone with significant time in country. In any case, decisions made in combat scenarios have very high stakes. It is therefore adaptive for those already in the field to regard newly assigned officers as a potential liability until proven otherwise. Newly minted officers, without prior boots-on-the-ground experience, are often out of touch with the combat tactics that are most effective within a given theater of conflict. Of course, this is no fault of their own. How would one know the best approach to take without direct knowledge of the combat theater? In such scenarios, the best officers, the ones their soldiers or Marines would take a bullet for, accepted guidance from their experienced NCOs. The proud and foolish among them were a liability to their soldiers, perhaps issuing authoritarian commands based on limited knowledge and putting their soldiers in reckless engagements as a result. When I viewed myself through the eyes of these patients, I saw that I would probably be perceived as an officer rather than an NCO. The parallel was too close to ignore. I entered the clinical collaboration with a set of higher degrees and a lack of direct military service history. Plus, I was early in my career, whereas my predecessor had been relatively more seasoned. While tension between officers and enlisted was salient for many of my Vietnam veteran patients, this is not nearly as often the case for veterans of more recent wars. However, even if the tension between parallel lines of military leadership has now lessened, any new member of a unit, whether officer or enlisted, is still the FNG, and thus enters
Sample complete. Ready to continue?